Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mohammed Kiyomi, President of California State University, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your moderator for today's program. And now it's my distinct honor and pleasure to introduce to you our distinguished speaker, Dr. Martha Cantor, U.S. Undersecretary of Education and former Chancellor of Foothill De Anza Community College District. In her role as the Undersecretary of Education, Dr. Cantor oversees policies, programs, and activities related to post-secondary education, adult and career technical education, federal student aid, and five White House initiatives. During the past 2 years, she successfully implemented the direct student loan program, resulting in a 50% increase in college enrollment, growing from 6 to 9 million students for those who are Pell Grant recipients. Dr. Cantor has been recognized by numerous organizations for her great leadership and has been recipient of many awards. She holds a doctorate from University of San Francisco in organizational leadership, a master's degree from Harvard University in clinical psychology, and a bachelor's degree in sociology from Brandeis University. Please welcome Dr. Martha Cantor.
Thank you, President Kiyomi, and congratulations on assuming the presidency of San Jose State University. You have an enormous challenge ahead of you, and it's going to be quite interesting, and I'm hopeful that California will solve the tremendous challenges you're facing for American higher education, K-12, and for children ages 0 to 6. So hopefully all of you will solve the problems of California, and thank you for having me here today. The federal government is very interested in being one of four partners in the equation to really make higher education better for the country. And we look at it as a vision of shared responsibility between students and families on the one hand, states, the institutions themselves like San Jose State University, Foothill De Anza Community Colleges, all of the institutions, University of California, Berkeley, any of the institutions in California that make up the public sector in partnership with the private sector. I was got my doctorate at the University of San Francisco. I'm going to give the graduation speech tonight at Santa Clara University's Graduate School. And it really has to be a voice for American education led by the states in partnership with the federal government, students and families, and the institutions themselves. And we've had a lot of fragmentation in the country. Everyone has an opinion. Everyone got an education who's over 25 or 30 or didn't get an education and has opinions about it. And I think the challenge is for the 50 states and all of the rest of us is to see what we can get consensus on and how we can move things forward, because we have dramatic challenges ahead of us to solve. So I'm honored to be here today at the Commonwealth Club. It's very exciting for me to talk about these issues with you. As you have heard, obviously, American higher education is a centerpiece of the Obama administration's policy agenda and has been since the president took office on January 20th, 2009. That was a date that he took office the same day Secretary Duncan, who's my boss, the Secretary of Education, took office, and I came about 6 months later. So I'll talk a little bit about where we are today, looking back a little bit at some of what we've done, and talk a little bit going forward about some things on the horizon. So this year, hopefully all of you saw the State of the Union address where President Obama released a blueprint for keeping college affordable and within reach for all Americans. And about a month later, President Obama went to the National Governors Association, and the White House then advanced what is being called an economy built to last, a blueprint for education. Now, both of these documents are on the White House website, and if you haven't read them, they give you more detail about what we'd like to see as an administration going forward. We talk about early learning, children 0 to 6. A third of children aren't ready for kindergarten, unfortunately, in the United States. We cannot afford that. It talks about what changes we'd like to see in the K-12 system. And really thinking through 0 to 6 and K-12 as a whole system that is partnering with American higher education. But in K-12, unfortunately, 25% of children aren't earning a high school diploma. And in some parts of the country, here in California and elsewhere, we're nearing 50% of children not finishing high school. So there's tremendous diversity. There's a lot of the good news is we have what I call islands of excellence all over the country where the achievement gap has been closed, where the kids are performing at high rates. And even in the lowest income communities, we can point to places that have turned around American high schools that have long undereducated children. We can point to early learning programs that are world-class. California just was fortunate to get an early learning challenge grant to move forward a lot of the innovation in 0 to 6. And we can point to colleges and universities where we've closed the achievement gap, schools with high graduation rates, schools with students that can pay back the loans after they graduate. And that's what we want for this country. We want strong schools, strong colleges and universities, strong early learning programs. And we don't want what we have today, which is the fact that if you just look at the higher education sector, and again, tremendous diversity in outcomes across all sectors of education, you see low graduation rates, high graduation rates, big achievement gaps, no achievement gaps. What we want is everyone improving to a high level of academic excellence and equity. So that really is sort of in a nutshell what we want. If we just focus on the higher education sector, when you look at the first-time full-time students, and again, this doesn't account the thousands and thousands of part-time students who are working two jobs just to make ends meet, immigrants that are coming in from the country that aren't speaking the second language to be college ready so quickly, the tremendous diversity of now 1.5 million veterans coming back into the U.S. over the next 5 years. We've got really a melting pot of people to educate, and that's been historically, California's led the way in this, I know quite well from my 35 years in the California system. But what we have in American higher education is only half of people who enter as first-time, full-time freshmen in American higher education in a community college, in a university, finishing in 6 years. So there are lots of reasons for that. You know, one of the big reasons is, you know, the cost of college, which is why you see our administration really focusing on a lot of principles, trying to put a lot of principles in place that will stabilize the fiscal health and well-being of American higher education. But coupled with that, a focus on improving performance across the board, because we simply have too much remediation going on across the country. I was just looking at some community college statistics. I came, from many, many years as first a teacher in the community college and then a dean and a president for 16 years. And you look at entering freshmen today in the community college system alone or the state university system, you're offering remedial courses at Cal State San Jose. And, you know, you have a streamlined program, but students that can't meet the level that you require for entering freshmen at San Jose State University, what happens to them? Where do they go? Why are we using curriculum that's what I call 20th century when we really need very different solutions to get students much better educated more quickly? So if you just look at the community colleges, 90% of entering freshmen have a math problem, or 75% of entering freshmen have an English language problem. So, and I call it a problem because they're not what Secretary Duncan talks about. They are not college and career ready to perform at the academic level to get them moving through in a career field that will help them earn a certificate or a degree, move up in the job that they currently have. They might be in an entry-level job and wanting to go to college to really advance in their career. They might be coming in for a whole new career. And when you look at the sciences, science, technology, math, and engineering, we have even a wider gap. You know, Women are falling out in the first year of entering freshmen. You can look at the National Academies just released a report on these topics about the achievement gap and the fact that we don't have enough women and minorities moving through the scientific fields with the courses of study that will prepare the workforce that the country is going to need going forward. So if you want to see the policy proposals, if you look at the blueprint for keeping college affordable and within reach for all Americans, and then you look at the education blueprint for an economy built to last, it'll give you sort of a wide view of the kinds of proposals we're looking at to really make this difference. Now, we know that the Georgetown University is right near my office in Washington, and we look to them because they've got a great center for education and the workforce. And they produced a report for every state in the country based on labor statistics from the Department of Labor and the Census that demonstrate that more than 60% of jobs in America are going to require a minimum of a college degree or certificate. So when you look at those jobs and you look at the jobs of the future, and there's a great line in a report that's on the web called Shift, S-H-I-F-T, Happens. You know, we're educating students today in part for jobs that may not yet exist. So if you just look at California's biotech proliferation of all the biotech companies and all the startups in bioscience that have happened just since the early 90s, there are new career fields, you know, nanoscience, analytics. All of these fields are going to require much higher levels of education and training. And when you look at in this report, you'll see the data that shows from the OECD, which looks at all of the countries around the world and compares how America is doing compared to Korea, Japan, Finland, Canada, and all those other countries. You'll see that a generation ago, we were first in the world, and today we're tied for 16th. So we have got to, as the president has asked, by 2020, and that's sort of my North Star. Arne Duncan talks about this in all his speeches. How can we increase by 50% the number of Americans in this country who are going to have already become college and career ready, that will earn baccalaureate degrees, associate degrees, all kinds of advanced training to be competitive in the world that is coming forward and is not stopping? It's only getting more and more nuanced and complex. So we are going to have students that are really ready for this, and we don't have that today in large measure because of the problems that we have had, not only in the K-12 system, but in American higher education and in preparing children. So our agenda sort of boils down to a simple phrase: invest in education as a shared responsibility, and have everyone who's a partner in this shared responsibility do more. So we want students and families to do more than having their children apply to only one college. More than 50% of students who complete a federal student aid form only apply to one college. And we'd like students to choose. We'd like to do what we can at the federal level in partnerships with states and institutions like San Jose State and others to move students toward the best colleges that they can go to that are reasonable, that they can afford, that have the kind of quality, that have the graduation outcomes, that have the employment outcomes, that have loans that are affordable, so that these students are not stopping out or dropping out of college to create what I talked about, which is that 50% gap that we have of students not finishing if you just look at the first-time full-time students. So where do we go from here? We've got to, you know, understand that first, as a country, students who get education after high school, that a high school diploma isn't enough. A high school diploma is just not going to cut it for too many Americans going forward. So we want to get more education and training for people. There's a big debate in the country, and I sort of say, let's stop the debate about college for all. This is not about college for all. It is post-secondary training and education for all. When President Obama in February talked about this vision, he talked about a minimum of at least 1 year of education beyond high school. It's great if you want to become an electrician, a plumber, a steel worker, a firefighter, a policeman. You may be able to get a certificate and or a degree going forward, but we don't have a culture in the country yet of what we are going to need, which are lifelong learners who will get a good education, get a good job, and continue to advance in their education and training over a lifetime. You know, I was a teacher. I always wanted to be in education. I loved education. I'm still a teacher in many ways. But for students today and tomorrow, they may have to change careers. And, you know, it was very disheartening when I, in July, I came into the government. So I've been there for 3 years and trying to learn all I can and do everything I can. And we went to Macomb Community College, which is in Warren, Michigan. And the president gave a speech there. And we talked to people on the assembly line in the automotive plant who were being laid off, and they were not ready to transition into the robotics plant that was being built that had the need for employees. They didn't have, again, the mathematics, the language, the science that I want, and I think we all want this generation and the generations that follow to be able to at least have the choices to be able to change careers over time if the economy is going to continue to have the ebbs and flows that have had, you know, over my 60-plus years, you know, as an American. We know that the earnings, if you just want to talk earnings, and I have a great slide that we can make available to you if you're interested in more of our data, that shows that the more money you earn as an American, the more you will pay into taxes, and that trajectory is pitted against how much education you get. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics talks about that high school graduates in 1979 earned about 72 cents on the dollar for a bachelor's degree holder. And today it's about 55 cents on the dollar. So you can see that a bachelor's degree is going to really, high school graduates in 1979, 72 cents on the dollar. Today it's 55 cents. So you can see the trajectory that you're going to have more education after high school. And another fact is the disparity between weekly earnings today is greater for high school graduates than both the gender and racial pay gaps. So we have got to get a more educated society. If you don't remember anything else from what I've said, students with a bachelor's degree will earn over $1 million more over a lifetime than students only with a high school diploma. So there's an economic imperative, but I also talk about, and the president talks about, the moral imperative, and I add to that the civic imperative. How are we going to manage a democracy that's secure and prosperous without the kinds of citizenry that we are going to need as a country going forward? So I've talked about the racial and pay gaps. I've talked about our international competitiveness, the dropout rate. We're losing over 1 million students every year out of high school. We lose a high school student every 22 seconds. And we've got to find a way to keep them in and just say no to anybody who's going to stop out or drop out. We've got to have our systems be much more flexible to keep people in and moving forward and getting that kind of progress that we all would like. So just for a couple more minutes, let me talk about what we've done as a policy agenda and what we're going to do going forward. And I think I have something like 6 more minutes left to do this in, which I'll try. So one of the first things I did in that first year of 2009 was look at one of the biggest investments in higher education that we have, thanks to Senator Claiborne Pell, which created a Pell Grant, and it will have its 40th anniversary very soon, this summer. And the Pell Grant was a way to say, since the GI Bill, that every American who could not afford college because of income should be eligible for a Pell Grant that would allow that student to go on and get an education. And so in the last 3 years, when I came in, we had 6 million students from the lowest income families in America in American higher education. Today we have about 26 million undergraduates. So take the 26 million. We had 6 million people getting those Pell Grants in 2009. Today we have 9.8 million. So in 2.5 years, we've really ramped up the opportunity for all. I call it opportunity for all. I talk a lot about the top 100% of people having the opportunity to go to college. Now, they have to make academic progress to continue to get a Pell Grant, and there are lots of proposals about how are we going to make this investment that the Congress has made with the President's leadership sustainable. Because if we continue that trajectory upward, we're going to have a gap that we're going to have to fill. So we have been very strong. The President really has spoken out that the Pell Grant is a line in the sand for this administration, tied to the fact that we want students from the lower income sectors of the country to be able to afford college, to have the dream to go. I was with a bunch of researchers, Dr. Duckworth, who you might know from California, talking about how kids lose hope at third grade. They lose hope that they could go, that they don't have aspirations. They fall out in middle school. And what we have to do is what Arne Duncan calls a cradle-to-career agenda that really attacks the education problem simultaneously at all levels. And it's very, very ambitious. We can't do this alone. We've got to do it with states, with students and families, and with the institutions themselves, which is why we look to San Jose State and other institutions of higher education for the leadership about how to tackle these problems, because they are community problems. They're regional. They're local. And at the federal government, we want to be a catalyst and use the money we do have to make the kind of change we're going to need. So the good news was that Congress voted as part of the Healthcare and Education Affordability Act to allocate $40 billion to the Pell Grant for the next 10 years between now and 2020. So we have been on a trajectory with that. You see a tremendous growth in the number of students. What's interesting, when I was looking at the Pell Grant data, if you look at the lowest income people in the country, people with incomes below $10,000 a year, we have doubled, more than doubled, the number of those people entering higher education. So I really, when I think about it, I think about, you know, the opportunity to lift the nation step by step. And if we lift everyone, you know, students who are smart, who can go right through, who don't have the level of academic underpreparation, we need to accelerate them more quickly. We need to get them into all the things that they can do. If they can do advanced analytics and they can do this in 11th or 12th grade, why have them sit in a class where they're not learning and put them over at the universities and let them accelerate and give the teachers the curriculum much more time for the students that do need more time to learn it. I don't know about you, but I had to use three different books when I didn't get a concept and, you know, study what it was like and how it was explained from different faculty, different professors in higher education or K-12. So we can't assume that everyone learns in the same way, and they don't. We have 6,700 institutions of higher education in the country. As I said, tremendous diversity across the country. And so for the Pell Grant change, what we did was we basically decided we will create what's called the direct lending program now. And instead of the money going from the Treasury to the lenders to the students, the money goes now from the Treasury to the students. So we saved $40 million. We put it into Pell Grants. We used a portion of it. It was actually a portion of it to pay down the deficit. And we still have a shortfall because of this dramatic growth. So that's the good news, that we have more students in higher education. The challenge is going to be going forward, how do we make this sustainable? And I'm confident we've got a lot of smart people in this country to help us. The other thing that you're hearing a lot about right now is keeping the 3.4% interest rate on Stafford and Perkins loans stable for students and families today and tomorrow. So it looks like we're having some movement on that, but again, it's up to Congress to not have students pay more than they would pay than banks are paying when they borrow money from the Treasury. It's just not fair. So we have also a very, very strong proposal to keep the interest rate what it is today. Another thing we did was to simplify applying for federal aid, grants, and loans. We cut out half the questions on the federal student aid form. It takes 20 minutes now. You can probably get through it 15 if you've got good technology skills, and it used to take over an hour. How did that happen? We wanted to simplify things. I used sort of Einstein's quote, which is things should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. And that sort of guides us. So when I look ahead, I say, why do we need the form if the federal government has the income data on the majority of Americans? why do we need the bureaucracy that we created? It was created, 40 years ago for good reason. It got worse and worse as the regulatory burden increased. But what we want to do is simplify. So we're very interested in that. As a result, our applications increased by 20%. We've seen a 12% net increase in the students coming from low-income families. You see the result right now from 6 million to 9.8. The president also has put into place what we're calling income-based repayment, so that after you graduate, if you take a loan, and the cost of college is students are coming out of college on average with about $25,000. Some of the high cost, if you're in medicine, you're going to come out with much more than that. But if you have a federal direct loan, you will pay no more than 10% of your income. So that means if you decide to go into teaching, and goodness knows we're going to need 1 million teachers, so we have a real opportunity to change the teaching profession, to put back respect into the teaching profession, and really build a teaching profession that's going to come from the top half of our graduates going forward. You could actually use income-based repayment and a new program that we have now in place that's permanent, public service loan forgiveness. So those teachers will pay no more than 10% of income if they work in a public in a nonprofit or a public institution, and their loans will be forgiven completely after 10 years, after 120 regular payments. Same for firefighters, same for government workers, police, the infrastructure that we're going to need to run our city. So we're very proud of those things. The other thing we haven't really talked a lot about, and we need to really make this explicit as a nation, is the American Opportunity Tax Credit. That will help many, many more people if they take advantage of up to $10,000 for their undergraduate years, up to $2,500 a year for 4 years. You have to finish your first year, your second year, to get that income tax rebate on your taxes. But again, people don't know about this. They don't apply for it. And it's another way to manage the costs of the escalation in college costs. Now, what we want to do going forward, and as I said, it's shared responsibility. We want students and families to use the transparent information we're making available on the cost of college, understand the difference between the net price and the sticker price of a college. So many people will flip when they see this college is really costing me $50,000, but then you have to ask, what is the net price, and how much federal aid, how much state aid, how much grants, scholarships, and loans do I have to package up to keep that college affordable? And the net price is very different in the majority of institutions across the country than the sticker price. So the sticker price has traditionally, for people that can afford the sticker price, that money has been used to pay the full cost so that you can have a complement of that top 100% in the institutions. Many of the international students are paying the sticker price, for example, and it's allowing colleges like San Jose State to really survive and balance the budgets on these dramatic state cuts that we're seeing. We'd like Congress to make the American Opportunity Tax Credit permanent. The income-based repayment, that 10%, will become permanent this year. The big challenge for us is, what do we do as a federal government to help states restore the funding that they've cut to American higher education? So the state universities, we've had a 40% cut, for example, at Cal State San Diego, at Chico, I was looking at Imperial Valley, at a number of the flagships, Berkeley State universities, community colleges. Students here are suffering, and this is not uncommon across the country. We've had 80% of states reneging on their commitment to keep a stable and predictable funding stream to American higher education. Some states are cutting state aid, which supplemented that Pell Grant I talked to you about. Other states are just doing dramatic cuts across the board in mid-year, which is causing the institutions who have a full-year budget to double up between January and June. So it's really been very difficult. And we're trying to think strategically about how can we help states look at some of the models around the country. New York State, for example, Governor Cuomo and the Congress in New York, the legislature in New York, passed a maintenance of effort for all of the public institutions in New York, the SUNY system, some of you may have gone there, and the CUNY system, to say we are not going to fund below the 11-12 year as a Congress, as a state, and we're going to increase tuition in the public institutions by no more than $300 a year for the next 5 years. That's in law. New York did this. It's not a panacea. Every state is different. All members of Congress are different across the country. But it's the kind of longer-range thinking. It's not yesterday's thinking. It's trying to plan for a stable, predictable funding stream. So we're very interested in using the competitive grant funding that we do have, the Pell Grant funding, to make it more performance-oriented, to ask states, how can you revamp the structure of state funding to be really stabilizing what we would like to see? And what can institutions do? We should not have institutions all over the lot when we know what the requirements are for entering freshmen. So right now, with raising college and career-ready standards in K-12, we want those standards to meet the expectations of entering freshmen at our university systems and at our community college. If you can write as a freshman, we ought to be very explicit about writing math and science requirements for entering freshmen, and those should align with what a high school diploma means. So that's a lot of work in K-12. There's a cost to that, but we've got to do things differently. And then we want states not only to support that better articulation, but also we're looking at the state aid that we have. We give state aid to campuses, and we want that aid to go to institutions that are giving students good value, that are serving high-need students, are increasing or stabilizing their commitment to serving high-need students because it costs more to serve a low-income student, and that are keeping the graduation rates and the repayment rates high on the graduation rates and low on the, manageable on the repayment rates. So it's about the whole packaging of how you think about value in an institution and moving the country to choose parents, students, and families to choose good quality institutions. So the president is establishing these proposals. They're in the budget. You can take a look at them. And the other thing I'll just end with is a need for much more innovation in American higher education. And there's a proposal just came out yesterday from the National Academies about the research agenda for America and investing in research and investing in higher education and K-12 as a way to actually stabilize and support and propel American prosperity and security, as I said at the beginning. So we have a lot of information that we're working on. We want these proposals to go forward. We're only as good as a whole. We're a democracy. So we have a lot of debate and discussion pretty much every single day. But we can't do anything more, in my opinion, than helping the country understand that by investing in education, being smarter with the money that we do have, and working together in that shared responsibility that President Obama has talked about quite frequently, Arne Duncan and myself, we can't do anything better than getting our children and the adults in this country better educated over time. We've got 93 million Americans today. That's more than 40% of adult Americans who are low-skilled. We cannot do that to the next generation and the next and the next. We've got to lift this country. So thank you for having me, and I'm happy to take the questions now.
Oh, thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Martha Cantor, U.S. Undersecretary of Education, former Chancellor of Fort Hill De Anza Community College, and now it's time to take questions. We have a number of questions, so we'll begin. The first question will be, Dr. Cantor, you talked about, you alluded to the cut that many states have seen in their higher education. For instance, California has, as you mentioned, more than 40% of cuts in the last couple of years. And I was relating that one to the report, Race to Zero, that came out a few years ago, where based on that one, as it was looking at the income of based on $1,000 of personal income since 1961 to 2012, in the next 20 to 25 years, for many states, that if that trajectory continues, the state funding will get to zero. Now, you mentioned the New York, state of New York. Are there solutions that one could see that one across the country?
Yeah, and I think it's going to take a lot of dialogue among the partners in every state. So, for example, in my 35 years in California education, the investments in the corrections and prison systems went up, and the investment in education, if you look over that last period of time, declined. So we make choices, and I think if I had stayed at De Anza College as a president, I was thinking about, could I take 5 or 10% of the low-collar kids that got into the prison system that shouldn't have been there? Could I turn them around? Maybe it was because I was a high school, continuation high school teacher years ago, and I was also a deputy probation officer. And, you know, we've got to think differently about our systems, is my point. Or, you know, every state gets youth employment funds. Well, if these kids are behind academically, how about a partnership between labor and education so the kids stay on track in the education sector while they're working in the summer with that youth employment job because they're in a low-income family, they need that job, and we want them to create, you know, the skills and knowledge to have the kind of work ethic and the ability to compete that we need for American society. So we need to think differently about the agencies and the states and the federal government. I can tell you, you know, we've been working pretty much every week with the Department of Labor. And, you know, when you look at the Pell Grant changes that we made, the IRS, I have to give kudos to the IRS for allowing us, trusting us, building a relationship so that we can now, American families can push a button when they want to apply for federal aid and have their prior year taxes ported in. I mean, it literally took a year and a half of figuring it out because we have such complex requirements, privacy laws, everything else. But it's doable if we just work at it. So we're going to have to really have this shared responsibility for looking at the investments that we currently have across the states. And every state is different, and every community is different, and understand what can we get consensus around to do things differently.
Okay. Well, thank you. A related question would be President Obama's maintenance of effort really was very successful in creating at least a limit on the amount of cuts that states were doing on education as a whole. Do you think there are some other instruments that the federal government have that could persuade states to not reduce funds for higher education even further?
Yeah, I mean, the good news when the president was elected was we had Recovery Act funds. The bad news is we don't have Recovery Act funds now. So we can't count on having a pot of money to stabilize some of the downturn from the economy. So we have to be much smarter about building back with what we have today. So is there a new Recovery Act funding stream in the future? I can't count on that as your undersecretary. I have to say, let's look at everything we have today and see what we can reform and get more out of. I don't want to have a Pell Grant go to a student that isn't making good academic progress. We're starting our rulemaking this summer on distance learning fraud rings. You know, goodness knows. We have funding streams. We can be smarter about the regulatory environment. We need to get rid of regulations. We're rulemaking on teacher preparation. People don't know we have 440 requirements that schools of education must meet to become a teacher, one of which is to take a test that has nothing to do with the teacher certification tests. We've got to throw that stuff out, and the good news is we didn't get official consensus, but we think we've got a lot of support to throw at least half of it out. And so with that time and money and effort, can we do the things that we really need to do, which are to create high-performing teachers in good schools of education that are graduating students that want to stay in the classroom, that really have a passion for teaching and a passion for education. So we've got to be smarter with what we have. And, you know, I'm not hopeful about Recovery Act money, but I think every state needs to look at every single investment. And, you know, gosh, you know, people that earn more should pay more. The president has been so clear on this. That hasn't happened yet. Can that happen? It's going to be the will of the people to make that happen.
Okay. Well, thanks. I have another question on the same line, and then I'll move to a different area. And that will be, many studies show that students coming from the upper economic quartile, they have an 80% chance of having a four-year college degree by the time they are 25, and those who are coming from the bottom economic quartile, that's only 8%. And given all of the other forces, what are the ways that we can really change that dynamics?
Yeah. I mean, you'll see a lot of proposals in K-12 for what is called personalized learning. Can we take the system of education that we have and reform the infrastructure of it so teachers can spend more time with students that are less prepared and spend less time and better curriculum? You can put, you know, bright young students into a class that might have 35 students, not 33. and use that other revenue to be put towards students that really need more time or special education or all the other kinds of things we do in terms of personalization to let more students go through in the whole faster with better education. So we need to reform the curriculum. There's actually a law that says the federal government does not get into curriculum. So we use federal funds to incentivize good curriculum that can be scaled and replicated around the country. And, you know, unfortunately, as a country, as states in the country, we need to spend much more time in figuring out how to replicate and scale what's working. And you've got Tony Breich here down at Stanford. He's dedicated his entire scholarship, his entire life has been dedicated to helping systems replicate and scale. And the federal government needs to do a much better job with that, so do states. When we know what works, we know, for example, if you streamline articulation and you use dual enrollment, put juniors and seniors who are ready for college into some of the college courses that they're ready for. We've got online. That's a new opportunity for us. You know, students are touching technology every single day. Our generation but most of our generation isn't touching it in the way that the young people are doing. So how can we leverage that to create much more acceleration for people that can take advantage of it in the education system and much more time for the personalization? I think we have to think differently, again, with the money we have. You know, could we have some larger classes to give more teachers in K-12 time to have smaller classes for young children? And how can we work with unions and all of the other system people, administration and faculty, to do things differently?
Thanks. On a similar area, we talked a little bit about you alluded to technology and the changes on the delivery systems. Are there ways that we can really leverage these ways in other sources such as Khan Academy and others, so we can really improve the learning experience of students?
Yeah, what we haven't done very well as a nation is really invest in the kind of research that are going to say, if you do these 20 things in K-12, in early learning and higher education, we will have a much higher graduation rate, we will have a higher quality student coming out, and we will have a better society in general. So we need to leverage technology. You know, we have MITx, and we have Coursera, and we've got new partnerships. I know that San Jose State University and others are talking with these private providers now about how can we actually use high-quality information. But again, many of the students don't have the technological skills from the lower-income sector. We've got to get those students trained up. It was interesting, when I went to India, Kapil Sibal, who's one of the senior leaders in the country, said that 90% of Indians have a cell phone. And I thought to myself, you know, we've got tremendous literacy problems in this country and in India. I mean, our future, our economy and our society and our prosperity is going to depend on the kinds of relationships we have with other democracies in the world, India being the largest democratic society that we have very, very wonderful relationships with. And, you know, how can we join forces and deliver high-quality education to every American so that we don't have that level of underpreparation? Technology is going to be a way to help us do this. I know that the Carnegie Institute for the Advancement in Teaching has spent the last 3 years with professors from around the country, leading scholars, figuring out how can we have an open access, open source online center that would take students from algebra through calculus or statistics. If you want to know about that, it's called QuantWay and StatWay. And we have a lot of community colleges and universities experimenting with this to say, what are the new roles for faculty with this kind of a delivery system? We can't just have what we've had in the last 50 years, a sage on the stage. We've got to have faculty that understand how to use these new technologies, but take the students that don't get it and give them the help that they need so that they can get into the mix and take advantage.
Again, for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth of California radio program. Our guest is Dr. Martha Cantor, U.S. Undersecretary of Education, who's discussing how to make college more affordable. And I'll go to the next question. The next question is, you already alluded to some of the students who are not prepared to get to college and a large number of remedials, both for community colleges and four-year institutions. I would be interested in hearing your views on how that could change. What are the things that we can really do to reduce the number of the amount of remedial for students?
Okay. So if you want to get rid of remedial courses, you're still going to have the same problem. So I don't think that is the way to go, although some states are saying, well, we're just not going to do that. And we're going to get rid of adult education, and we're going to get rid of remediation. We're still going to have underprepared people. So let's figure out, for example, and I think the Khan Academy is a great example, can we look to the faculty in the country and say, give us a world-class literacy curriculum that everyone can use? And what would it take to do that? And why aren't things working? So I just went to a conference a week ago Friday in Baltimore, and the name of the conference was Accelerated Learning. And it was community colleges from across the country who were coming together to look at what the faculty have done differently to provide more acceleration at the lowest levels of the curriculum. So traditionally what we've had is 3 to 5 levels of instruction in reading, mathematics, and science below the college level. So we have a whole bureaucracy, what I call a bureaucracy, under that college level, that level of college and career ready that we want for our K-12 children, and we want for entering freshmen if they come in from wherever they come in from. We have so many adults that need an education that dropped out at the age of 16, and now they're coming back at the age of 22. We have people with prison reentry. We've got, you know, the veterans I talked about coming back. So how can we create literacy for all? And that's the challenge of the nation, to do a much better job with these 21st century tools than we have done in the 20th century. So at this conference, I had faculty from Chabot College in the East Bay and from Los Medanos College in the Contra Costa Community College District, sharing what they've done to modularize the curriculum, put technology in, and not have students have to relearn what they already know, but concentrate on what they don't know. And that is a huge challenge for faculty in the basic skills. We've got some experts in the audience here today who are scholars in their own right in these areas. And we've got to have a much more flexible curriculum that's going to give the students the knowledge and skills that they don't have and not assume it's the same for all. And so that will actually create acceleration. And in the places where they were sharing research at this conference, they were having tremendous gains in those basic skills, moving students up faster. They were showing a 10%, a 15%. I was at a meeting yesterday looking at the lowest performing schools, high schools in the country, and looking at the gains, you know, 1.5 times grade level, catching up within 6 months or a year. So we've got to look at those acceleration models and then figure out how can we replicate and scale them and convince communities, the academic community, the principals, the college presidents, the faculty senate presidents, you know, the teachers of language arts, that we don't need to do the same things that we've always done for the last 50 years. We've got to do things differently and really learn from this new research and then encourage more research in this. That's significant. We have a Center for Postsecondary Success in New York at Columbia University. They've got some great research. They did a piece, 400,000 students in these leveled out basic skills courses going nowhere. 7% of them got degrees. You know, we cannot have that anymore. We don't need that. We've got to do things differently, but we can't walk away from it. We've got to put a different curriculum in place. We've got to really challenge the faculty to help us do that. We can't do it. They've got to really step up and do this.
Thank you. The next question is about the amount of debt that many of our current students are carrying based on the statistics of 2010 senior students. On the two-thirds of them, on the average, had about $25,000 or more debt. And especially many of them with the current economy, after they graduate, they cannot get employment. What are the ways that we can actually not only get the prospect of these students to be able to get employment, continue on, but also be able to be attracted back to the public sector and do civic work?
Yeah. So you have an institute in Oakland called the Institute for College Access and Success. And in 2009, they gave me a great education. And in the education they gave me, they said that for American higher education universities, 50% of students are using credit cards and private loans instead of the Stafford or Perkins loans that would be at 3.4% to buy their books or help out with the rest of college education because they didn't want to take a federal loan or they just didn't want to go there. Well, instead, they're paying double, triple, quadruple. For community colleges, 90% of the students that took a loan were using credit cards or a private loan. So families and students, parents and students, first understand the difference between a federal loan and a private loan. If you can't get a job after college, you can go into forbearance. There is not a penalty. If you've got a private loan, you're looking at bankruptcy. You're looking at all kinds of ways that, you know, you've got to deliver on that. There are attributes to taking your federal loan capability that we've got to educate Americans. We've got to educate Americans on what I said in my remarks, the American Opportunity Tax Credit. For public service loan forgiveness, we need to populate a declining, an aging out. I'm a baby boomer. Many of us are boomers, and we've got to get people ready for public service jobs and teaching. We need 1 million teachers between now and the year 2020. We've got a less mobile society right now. If you look at the mobility studies, the demographics, people aren't moving as much, but there are teaching jobs in this country, and people are aging out of teaching. So we've got to get people getting into the public service loan forgiveness, paying their loans every month for 120 payments at no more than 10% of income. So if they go to some place where the salary is $20,000 or $30,000 for a new teacher, they're only going to pay 10% on their discretionary income.
Okay, thank you. Our next question is about the DREAM Act and your position on that one, and how can we really motivate many of those students who unfortunately were not able to benefit from it?
Yeah, well, the good news, the president that was coming in here, the president had an announcement at 1:15 today, and we're 3 hours behind, so it was 10:15 walking over here. And, Janet Napolitano, who actually is a graduate of Santa Clara University, I'm going to mention her tonight, announced in Homeland Security would give a 2-year hiatus to children and people who are paying taxes here in this country, what would be called very, very low-risk individuals who are here in this country, who are contributing to the economy, and use all of those resources of Homeland Security to go after the people that are really creating the kind of high risk to the nation that we're all concerned about. So this is not the DREAM Act. We hope that Congress will pass the DREAM Act. The president's been very clear about this. We don't. We need more people from all walks of life, especially immigrants who are here, children who were born here, but for no fault of their own, their parents were born in another country, are not being afforded the opportunities here. We've got world class. I have one student who just couldn't make ends meet, transferred to Berkeley this last year from De Anza College. And, you know, has had to stop out because couldn't take advantage of any state support, a top student. And you see this time and time again. So we're not using the assets of the children that we have here or the adults. And we hope that the DREAM Act will pass. And in the meantime, we are using the legal authority that we have as a government, as an administration, to relax that risk for those that population that we think is a very, very low risk. And I think, it's doing things differently with what we have.
Thank you. But the next question is about the rising cost of education as a whole, and specifically, of course, for the public universities. The rise has been connected to the drop of funding from the states, and of course, in privates, it has been increasing quite a bit. Also, are there ways that we could reduce the cost of delivery of education? So hopefully, we can the raise of the tuitions will not rise as much as it has been.
Yeah, there's a college, a private college in the Midwest that is so confident about the quality of education and the graduates leaving that institution with baccalaureate degrees that they have said, we will pay your student loans, your direct loans. If you take a Stafford or a Perkins loan, we will pay that loan if your income is less than $20,000. And if your income is between $20,000 and $40,000, we'll pay pro rata. And if it's above $40,000, you've got to pay that cost. So we're seeing a lot of innovation. Ashland University in Ohio is putting in 22 three-year degrees. You'll save a whole cost of room and board for that third year. You'll have a job and continue your education in the summer. We need to think more year-round. These are the kinds of innovations we're seeing around the country, but what I said, you know, islands of excellence. And I have a list, if any of you are interested, of the kinds of things we're seeing that I think give me hope and promise that we can keep college affordable. These are things that are coming from the institutions themselves. No one is resting on this problem. Everyone has a problem about the cost of college. We want to be smarter with the federal funds to make sure that the existing federal funds we have are going to institutions that are giving good value to students. We don't want students to come out with huge debt that they can't repay that's going to burden the society. We also know that the less educated students are going to go into the healthcare system and need more social services than not. And we know that students with baccalaureate degrees or associate degrees, as an example, are twice as likely to be employed as students with only a high school diploma. So, you know, we can make those costs, those economic arguments about why this is so important, but we need the institutions themselves and the states to step up. So that's why I talked a lot about shared responsibility. The government can't do this alone. You know, we were fortunate to get recovery funds, but we've got to figure out, you know, how can we partner with states to build back the state investment in public higher education, make private higher education, not do price controls. We're not interested in price controls, but we think we can be a lot smarter than we have and really trying to constrain college costs, and it's going to be private sector will have one way to do this. Public institutions are often, you know, affecting the backfill and causing tuition increase because that's the only option they have. But, you know, can you consolidate back-end costs? McKinsey says, you know, the two big drivers, can we decrease the time to degree and fix remediation? Those are two huge levers of change that would create a 10 to 30% revenue stream to be used for more courses, building more capacity, and getting more students graduating.
Okay. Well, the next question is, want to have your view about the pros and cons of many public universities relying more on private contributions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a community college, traditionally we never fundraised. And so when I became De Anza College's president, I set up a foundation, raised $30 million, had great people helping us. But shame on us as a nation when now in July we're celebrating, June actually this month, is the celebration, the 150th year of the Morrill Act. And the idea was that the land-grant universities would be universities for everyone, and they would be affordable. So I went to the University of Northern Colorado as an example, and the president, Kay Norton, stood up and told a group of business leaders that we're becoming an enterprise institution. And so I would not like to, in my, you know, next 20, 30, 40 years that I'm going to be on the planet, see public education go away. I think we have to rethink the value of public education, why the land grants were created in the beginning, the value of the community colleges in preparing the regional workforce and in getting students the pipeline to the university system that we're going to need. And this is, as I said again, you know, a shared responsibility for all. And it's a great concern to all of us in the administration, which is why we have so many proposals that are really targeting the different sectors of higher education. We can't think of one size fitting all. That's not the way higher education has proliferated, and we love the diversity of American higher education, from our Research One universities to the community colleges, the state universities, the for-profit institutions. We have such variation that one size will not fit all. So I'm confident that in partnership with states, we can do a lot better than we have in this last generation.
Thank you. Well, the next question is on financial aid, but it's a more specific question. And apparently, and currently in the financial aid, only the custodial parents' income is really considered. And if does that give a motivation for the lower income parent to be the custodial parent? And are there ways that we can make the other parent also be responsible for the education of the child?
Yeah, I think that's much more of a specific question that I would have to refer to our federal aid experts about who qualifies as a parent and what the total income. Everybody's personal income situation is different. We've got I was just looking at the foster youth, because there used to be 500,000 foster youth in the country. Today we have 400,000 foster youth because they have found families that are helping those children. They get emancipated at age 18 and they come to higher education or they come to the streets. And what we want is, foster youth that are going to go on and graduate and be successful citizens. And there have been a lot of issues about, when the state and the federal government are in loco parentis, what's our responsibility for helping those foster youth and making it simpler for them to get the federal student aid that they qualify for, because they're from the lowest income families in the nation. They've been in foster care for X number of years. And the same situation, I guess, in the question is, do we count the income of the father and the mother? That's going to be a situation where it's an individual situation, and that's why we have a hotline and an ombudsperson at the Federal Student Aid Office. We have an 800 number. We man it for 24 hours a day. You can call up and get a human being on the other end who will help you figure out that situation, who qualifies to get those students the kind of support, and not game the system. That's the other thing, with this distance learning fraud rings I talked about and all the other ways that these structures, these systems can be misused, misappropriated. We've got to do as much compliance as we can, but really create the kind of systems for the 21st century, especially with technology, that are going to flag misuse or waste or fraud or abuse.
Okay. Well, the next question is about community college transfers, especially would that be one way of reducing the cost of education if we direct more and more students to community college, but in a way that they will be able to transfer to a four-year institution much easily and more of them will transfer?
Yeah, I think there are incentives, but I like to think that students and families should have choice. So if a student wants to and qualifies, we have a tremendous undermatching in the country of more high-quality institutions that can take students that students don't apply to. So it's a question of choice, and I think, frankly, do you want a huge migration to the community colleges because they are the lower-cost institutions? I think that's an economic solution that people have talked about, and I would not like to see that happen, because I'd like students and families to really look at how can they match their means with a high-quality institution, whether it's a public or a private four-year or a two-year community college. Money just published all the lists of community colleges, U.S. News and World Report. There are all kinds of ways to look at quality and cost, and we've got to do a better job with states in looking at high-quality institutions by sector so students can decide, do they want a two-year or a four-year? But I would not like to see state policy trying to migrate people to one sector or another. I think the diversity of American higher education has been just that you have the kinds of choices to make. But again, we do have an undermatching. I know I had a student who was a 4.0, terrible student in high school, went to Eastside Union High School District in San Jose, came to De Anza, and when I met her, it was in the summer before her last year, and she had a 4.0, and she had already finished organic chemistry. And I said, where are you thinking of going? And she said, the State University down the street. And I said, is that the only place you're thinking of? Yes, because it's the one I know. And I said, just go and look at all kinds of institutions. And she ended up graduating with a double major in math and in physics and math from Columbia. They met her full need. It was a great opportunity for her. Another student went to San Jose State. It was a great opportunity to that student. But we've got to really allow that choice for families so that they think of a lot of different options. And as I said at the beginning, too many students are only going to the local place that they know, and we want much more choice and comparisons in grants and loans, comparison in public and private loans. If you have to take a loan, don't use your credit card, but take a direct loan first, take a private loan second, don't use the credit card till third. That's a huge, huge need in financial literacy that we have as a nation. It ties to the literacy challenge I talked about.
Well, thank you. I think we're getting to the end of our time at this time. I'd like to thank Dr. Martha Cantor, U.S. Under Secretary of Education and former Chancellor of Fort Hill De Anza Community College District. We also would like to thank our audience here on radio and TV and internet, as well as being here in person. I'm Mohammed Kiyomi, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the place that you need to be to know is adjourned.
Thank you.
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 Thank you.